This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. In terms of history, it may turn out the most significant moments at the 2018 Winter Olympics occurred during the opening ceremonies.
Athletes from both North and South Korea marching out under one unified flag to a...
The Winter Games in South Korea have included the North Koreans, or at least a select few of them. North Korean cheerleaders, resplendent in red and beaming in unison, brought enthusiasm even to games that were hopelessly one-sided. North Korean women joined their South Korean counterparts to create a unified women's hockey team that lost hopelessly one-sided games. North Korea's leader even sent his sister to shake hands with the president of South Korea. Was the participation of athletes and cheerleaders from North Korea a good idea? Well, yes, if you believe any contact between the two regimes is better than none. No, if your main concern is that even minimal inclusion provided North Korea with propaganda opportunities for its repressive regime. But regarding the last time North Korea tried to shoulder its way into the spotlight shining on international competition, there's perhaps no debate about their success. Return with me now, well, with me and journalist Bradley Martin, to 1988, when South Korea played host to the Summer Games while North Korea fumed.
Well, the North Koreans were going berserk. They could see that they were losing the economic race. Up until the 70s, they had thought that they were ahead of South Korea. And they did do a pretty good job of, building their economy on the communist system. But then that started to flag. So it was a rough time for the North Koreans, and they particularly envied the South Koreans their 1988 Summer Olympics. That just drove them crazy.
Maybe crazy explains how North Korea chose to respond to those 88 Summer Games in Seoul after their offer to co-host the show was rejected. The leadership of North Korea figured they'd stage their own games.
It was sort of an Olympics for the socialist bloc, and that included a lot of social democratic ruled countries in Europe.
It wasn't a new idea. The World Festival of Youth and Students had been staged in Prague, East Berlin, Moscow, and Havana, among other cities. Pyongyang might have seemed the next logical place to showcase the talents of young athletes from communist countries, if not for the early departure of logic from the proceedings. Absent the help the Soviet Union couldn't or wouldn't continue to provide, the North Korean economy was a wreck. But when Bradley Martin arrived on assignment from Newsweek before the World Festival of Youth and Students opened, he saw that the host nation's ambitions were grand.
There were all these skyscraper apartments, whole district of them, and the plan was for the delegates to stay there first, and then the high-rise apartments would be turned over to ordinary people. And there were all the venues, wonderful stadiums, and that sort of thing.
The stadiums and that sort of thing had been built by a mass labor campaign. The main stadium, with a capacity of 150,000 people, was particularly impressive, but it was dwarfed, at least vertically, by the 105-story hotel that was allegedly almost finished when the athletes, their entourages, and the journalists arrived in July. Bradley Martin was present for the opening ceremonies, during which scores of birds were released into the sky over Pyongyang. The soldiers in attendance were perhaps too quick to fire off a traditional salute.
The birds went crazy. They were so upset, and it was really, I felt rather ironic at the time. It struck me as symbolic, because the country still was and still is totally militaristic. You know, that's the emphasis there.
Once the terrified birds had fled the scene, or perhaps fallen lifeless from the sky, the games began. Basketball and volleyball were among the attractions, as were juggling, acrobatics, various circus acts, and musical performances. The festival also included political discussions, so after checking out some spear throwing, it was off to the anti-imperialist tribunal, or the solidarity rally with the people, youth, and students of Nicaragua. Though the spectacle likely dazzled some onlookers, Bradley Martin had a job to do. He'd heard about an upcoming human rights demonstration, which would be a large deal in a nation opposed to such things, so he tried to find the planning meeting.
And the taxi driver took us out in the country for an hour or two and pretended he was lost. He did not want us to go to that. He did not want us to go over there and gather that news. So it was total control, and it always has been.
But there were limits to total control, even in Pyongyang, in part because the North Koreans hadn't closed their festival to delegates from nations less totally controlled than their own.
The visitors were all playing rock and roll on their little boom boxes, and the North Koreans had never heard such a thing, so they were out there shaking their booty and just having a great time. And I thought, wait a minute, you know, this is the beginning of what the North Korean rulers do not want to see. You know, people were starting to realize, hey, this is kind of fun what they've got over there in those horrible capitalist, imperialist countries that we keep hearing so much about.
The infestation of the devil's music, or at least the music of the imperialist Great Satan, wasn't the only problem for the North Korean elite. The billions of dollars spent on the spectacle was money North Korea didn't have, and although the enormous stadium built for the World Festival of Youth and Students is still used for soccer matches and choreographed demonstrations, the 105-story hotel still isn't finished, and as for the district of skyscraper apartments...
Today, no one wants to live there because you have to take an elevator to get up there, and there's very little electrical power available in North Korea. So if you have one of those apartments, you're basically stuck there. It was a total failure. First, it finished wrecking the economy. I mean, they spent so much money on this. And meanwhile, they had defaulted on their debts to Western countries and the Soviet Union from the 70s. So the world's financial community said, what are these guys doing? They're going and spending this money that they won't give back to us. And look, what are they getting out of it? Basically nothing in terms of productivity or any lasting good thing for their economy. So it was sort of the last hurrah before the economy collapsed in the 1990s, totally collapsed.
Any number of Western cities seduced into thinking that hosting the Olympics or the World Cup would be beneficial in the long run can sympathize. Think Montreal, 1976. The Canadians finally finished paying for those games 30 years later. Or think Rio, 2016, where the construction of venues currently derelict has left an already struggling economy with an additional debt of at least $40 million. But North Korea's 1989 boondoggle was apparently colossal, even Olympian, at least according to Bradley Martin, whose reporting got back to the North Koreans.
Somebody in New York kept putting the term personality cult into my cover story. It was in there about three or four times, and that offended the North Koreans so much that I was put on a blacklist.
Martin was not allowed back for another 3 years, at which point he continued to be unimpressed by the place, or at least by the sincerity of its leaders, and he's no fan of the nation's appearance in the games to the south.
Basically, what we're seeing here is the most obvious North Korean charm offensive. I've studied North Korea long enough to know that what North Korea wants to do is to conquer South Korea. That's the ultimate goal of North Korea. And every now and then they'll put on one of these charm offenses, and it works. It works. It gets lots of starry-eyed young people thinking, oh, peace. We can have peace if only the evil Americans would get their troops out of South Korea. So basically, I thought the whole thing was a charade.
Okay, so at least one guy who's been to Pyongyang and seen the great big unfinished hotel and been driven around the countryside by a taxi driver playing dumb isn't buying the cheerful cheerleaders and let's play hockey together. It's safe to say he'd have been happier if the North Koreans had stayed home. We first learned about the 1989 Festival of Youth and Students from a New York Times article titled North Korea's Would-Be Olympics, A Tale of a Cold War Boondoggle. For more on Bradley Martin's adventures in North Korea, check out his book, Under the Loving Care of the Fatherly Leader. We'll have links to both at onlyagame.org. North Korea is far from the first country to try to change its reputation on the international stage via a sporting event. Today on the show, we're going to look at other times when sports and international relations have collided. Next stop, Saigon, 1967.
It would have been this surreal sight during this short period of the Vietnam War where footballs were just falling off the top of this hotel every day during training.
And then to Garmisch-Partenkirchen for the lesser-known 1936 Winter Games.
They didn't acknowledge the Führer, and the Führer responded by being furious.
Sports as international relations coming up on Only a Game from NPR. Many thanks to Falling Fruit for leaving the following 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. I love Only a Game. It's smart, informed, and accessible to anyone. I'll tell you, I am a much bigger sports fan myself since I first started listening. Thank you for your great work and giving me some talking points with the sports fans in my life. Thank you, Falling Fruit, and thanks to everyone who's left a review of our show. If you haven't done it yet, give it a try. I'm told the hardest part is coming up with a username. Falling Fruit, really?
What does it take to start something from nothing? And what does it take to actually build it? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on How I Built This, I speak with founders behind some of the most inspiring companies in the world. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Bill Littlefield, and it's time for 3 stories you should know. This week, Sports Illustrated released a report about a culture of sexual harassment and abuse in the Dallas Mavericks organization, and that's where we're going to start this week. I'm joined by sports writer and editor Patrick Ruby and Julie DeCaro, an update anchor and host at Chicago's 670 The Score via Skype. Welcome back to both of you.
Always good to be here.
Hey, Bill, how you doing?
I'm doing fine, and will you please start us off?
So apparently all of this started sometime prior to 2007 when women had reported Maverick CEO Terdama Yousry to the organization for multiple instances of sexual harassment, including everything from really inappropriate conversations with women to trying to kiss them to constantly touching their legs during meetings. When the organization didn't do anything, the women decided to start documenting it themselves. It is just now all coming out what's happened. Yousry has moved on from the organization. He's denying all this. There was another situation also in the Mavericks organization with writer Earl K. Sneed, who apparently was in a domestic fight with his then significant other. He was arrested for it. He had to go through counseling. And then once he was done with that and the charges had been dropped because he'd complied with all the court requirements, he then was dating another person from the Mavericks organization who he also was physically abusive towards, and she wound up coming to work with bruises all over her face. He was retained by the organization. Unfortunately, it's one of those things where everyone in the organization seemed to know what was going on. No one did anything about it. And now Mark Cuban and several other high-profile people in the organization are saying that they had no idea this was happening, despite the fact that many of these women had gone to HR about the problem. So it's really disappointing, I think, that it falls to reporters to expose this kind of stuff rather than having people in the organization be the ones to take care of it.
I'm glad this particular story is coming out, but I'm sure there's a lot of denial and covering up going on everywhere in this country still. It really makes me depressed about the culture and what it says about our collective culture and how we do not take this problem seriously. And there is a lot of misogyny.
My understanding is that Yousry was the most powerful guy in the building. I mean, except for Mark Cuban, and Cuban apparently was not often in the building. So this is a classic case, I think, of the most powerful guy thinking he could get away with whatever he wanted to in terms of harassment and behavior like that. I don't believe Mark Cuban was as ignorant of all this behavior as he says he was, because his reputation is as a very aware and hands-on sort of owner. But it is, I think, encouraging, and I want to close on the encouraging note. Nobody is defending this behavior. Nobody is saying, oh, come on, shake it off, this is how it is. And we have the women who have come forward, as Julie has mentioned, to thank for the change that is occurring. And I hope that the evidence that the change is occurring gets more and more dramatic as we go along.
Yeah, I think it is great that it came out. I hope that it empowers a lot of women to come forward in their own workplaces. But, you know, one of the things I want to point out, too, is that one of the issues in this case was that the HR rep for the Dallas Mavericks, he was known to send out emails about, you know, anti-abortion stuff and anti-gay stuff, anti-same-sex marriage to the people that were his buddies in the organization. And I think that this is something women have run into in other organizations as well. When you go to HR and the HR guy isn't really on your side mm-hmm. because he's kind of a sexist himself. So that is something that I think organizations are really going to have to look at, that these are going to have to be better documented and you're going to have to take a better look at how HR responds to people.
Patrick, let's move on to your topic.
So my story is from the Winter Olympics, and there's a good chance you've heard about it, if only as a punchline. There's a Russian curler. His name is Alexander Krushelnitsky, and I may be botching that name, so apologies in advance. He was stripped of his bronze medal after failing a doping test. And of course, the reaction is what you'd expect. Doping in curling? I mean, that's like a broom-pushing sport. It's essentially high-stakes house cleaning on ice. On the surface, you know, it's a funny story, but underneath, it's a pretty serious indictment of what a failure our sports war on drugs have been. The actual drug our friend Alexander was busted for is called Melodium. It's a heart medication used in Eastern Europe, and it's believed to improve performance by boosting blood flow. There's really no good scientific evidence that Melodium actually boosts performance. It was just banned a few years ago because a lot of Eastern European athletes were taking it. Now, that's a pretty flimsy reason, I think, when it comes to actually punishing and policing people. But let's say that Melodium actually works, right? If that's the case, we still shouldn't be surprised because, of course, curlers are going to dope. They're trying to win. Even if you're a curler, if you're not doping, you're probably not trying hard enough. Now, one last thing about this. You know, they run thousands of drug tests at the Olympics. So far, four athletes total have been busted. Now, does anyone think only four athletes at the whole Olympics are doping? Of course not. You know, we know from anecdotal evidence and from anonymous surveys that at the highest level of sports, it's at least 30% of athletes and probably a lot higher are using drugs at some point. So instead of laughing at our Russian friend, I think we should ask a question. If a curler's doping qualifies as a headline-making victory on a battlefield where we know doping is rampant, then how is the actual war really going?
One of the things I think that is so funny about this is, you know, we've gotten this idea that if you're using performance-enhancing drugs or if you're doping, it's to be like Barry Bonds and to be like a giant home run hitter. So everyone's right. Laughing at it. But so much of this is about recovery and about stamina. And I mean, I think that a lot of that is what this doping is about. At the same time, I think we all knew that once Russia was let into this thing, that this was going to happen and it was just going to be a matter of them trying to catch it. But I have no doubt that there are many, many more people on many, many more teams from many, many more countries that are getting away with it as well.
All right. Well, I appreciate that you both have made some important and solemn points. And I'm sorry, I can't help myself. A curler has cheated by taking a performance-enhancing drug. This, to me, is like lifting weights in order to prepare for a spelling bee. And I just can't help it. I'm sorry. It's funny.
Google nude curling calendars, and you will see some of these curlers.
No, I'm not going to do it. No. Life is short, Patrick. I'm going to move on to my topic. I have recently become aware of Grand Canyon University because Dan Marley, who used to play for the Phoenix Suns, coaches that university's men's basketball team, and they're good. Matter of fact, they're good enough to move from D2 to D1, and they may reach the NCAA tournament this year. But some of their potential opponents are very upset because Grand Canyon U is a for-profit institution. And as far as I'm concerned, yeah, so what? D1 programs at the allegedly nonprofit schools are very interested in generating revenue, booster donations, seat licenses, TV contracts, sales of jerseys worn by guys that don't get paid. Just because Grand Canyon U is bringing in a lot of money, I'm told hundreds of millions of dollars each year, because they got about 70,000 students pursuing degrees from wherever their computer terminals are, Should they be shut out of the college sports money grab? And I say no. They're no more hypocritical than, for example, UNC or Baylor. Patrick, what do you think?
I say hell no. I agree with you 100% about this. Of course they should be allowed to be part of this competition. If anything, I think what it also shows their entry into big-time basketball is it's a real counter to the idea of, oh, we can't afford to like pay players a fair rate because nobody's making any money. Well, if your industry isn't making money, why do schools keep entering it? You know what I mean? Like, this is a pretty clear example of all the benefits, financial and otherwise, that schools get from having a prominent, successful football or basketball program. So I'm all for it. And if anything, I wish that Greg Kelly could find a way to wedge themselves into this NCAA cartel and somehow pay players and break the cartel. But that probably won't happen.
It is like, you know, the height of hypocrisy for any school, a Division I NCAA school, to complain about another school having too much money and being for profit. Right. It's insane to me. Like Patrick said, if this is such a, you know, nonprofit thing, why do you guys keep doing this? Why are basketball coaches among the highest paid employees in every single state in this country?
The final word on this one is just that hypocrisy and corruption live, and the challenge will be to enjoy the basketball anyway once March Madness gets underway. And I'm sure that millions of people will have no problem doing that and betting on the outcome as well. My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Julie DeCaro. She's an update anchor and host at Chicago's 670 The Score, and sports writer and editor Patrick Ruby, whose writing you can find in The Atlantic, Washingtonian Magazine, and elsewhere. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure, Bill.
Our next story of international diplomacy via sports is a bit backwards. Instead of the host country attempting to win over the visitors, this one involves the visitors trying to win over the host country. Reporter James Parkinson has the story.
It was one of those stories that you heard at a bar with colleagues and ex-players, and you thought, is this really true? Could this really be a thing?
That's sports journalist David Corin.
Surely this didn't actually happen. It's not the way they said it, except that it really did actually happen. It really was the way they told it.
It was November 1967, at the height of the Vietnam War, when an international football tournament was held in Saigon. Eight nations would compete: New Zealand, Thailand, Malaysia, Singapore, South Korea, Hong Kong, then South Vietnam, and Australia.
The Australian military came up with the idea of using football as a sort of a vehicle to kind of connect with the local communities. This wasn't just a football tournament. There were other motives.
We were the pawns in the game to win over the South Vietnamese people. So it was a PR exercise.
This is Ray Bartz.
Yeah, hi, I'm Ray Bartz. I'm a former Socceroo. I played with the Australian national team from 1967 to 1974.
After making his national team debut earlier in the year, Ray was one of the players selected for a six-week tour of Asia, of which 2 weeks were spent in Saigon for the Friendship Tournament, otherwise known as the South Vietnam National Day Tournament. It's hard to imagine now, in the current era, with Australia competing in consecutive World Cups and Asian Cups, but in 1967, the Socceroos had never even qualified for a World Cup, let alone won an international trophy.
This was before the Socceroos were even called the Socceroos.
There was little time for the players to think about the potential dangers of sending civilians into a war zone.
I think it was about a matter of weeks. We were on the plane off to Vietnam. We didn't have too many discussions about it.
This is Stan Ackerley. He represented Australia from 1965 to 69 after emigrating from England.
These days, you would think twice about going. When you got a young family, well, I only had one daughter at the time, and my missus encouraged me to go. I was only a youngster, mid-20s, but being young and ambitious, all right, well, off we went to Vietnam.
Probably a little bit naive that we were going to a country that was in the middle of war, but at no stage did I think that it was going to be dangerous.
Then they landed in Vietnam and were immediately confronted with the reality of what they had walked into, and that started to change their understanding of what they were being asked to do.
Well, the first biggest shock we got was the amount of people we saw, soldiers, sentry points all over the place.
Bombers here and fighter planes here, there, and everybody thought, oh, hello. We are in the middle of a war zone, you know, and we got through the airport and then into the bus to take us to the hotel and had a police escort all the way.
You have a fair bit of shooting going on. You know, it's taken a couple of days for us to, you know, get used to it.
They went to this briefing at the embassy, and one of the things they were told was be careful of people riding on bikes because it might be someone who's a threat and they could mistake you for an American or a soldier and attack you and shoot you, which, you know, might seem like reasonable advice, except that these players in this completely new surrounding walk out of the Australian embassy, and what do they see? Just a city filled with people riding around on bikes.
You know, to be on the bus and whizzing around through the streets and avoiding all the motorbikes and the traffic of Saigon and, you know, the poverty that was quite obvious around and the number of people and whatever. When we got to the hotel, we had a lovely welcome from the Vietnamese people. The hotel was very basic.
Basic is one way to put it. The players discovered the proprietor of the hotel had stolen their food vouchers, leaving them with nothing but substitute ham. And Stan Ackerley received an electric shock thanks to exposed wires in his room. Even the training pitch was questionable. Here's Ray again.
The training field was a real quagmire at the best of times. So, you know, you couldn't train there all the time because of the conditions and that. It was really a cow paddock. You know, quite often we'd train on the roof of the hotel, just keep the body moving a little bit. You know, we weren't allowed to train on the main stadium.
There would have been a surreal sight during this short period of the Vietnam War where footballs were just falling off the top of this building, this hotel, every day during training.
What's more, it was later revealed that they escaped an even greater threat.
A number of Viet Cong were caught trying to break into our hotel to, set off explosives on the floor where the South Koreans were, and of course we were above them.
The tournament began with a group stage. Australia were drawn into Group A alongside New Zealand, Singapore and host South Vietnam.
The army was going around the stadium with mine detectors and so forth, and then you think, oh, hello.
Australia opened the tournament against New Zealand. It was monsoon season and the humidity was extreme.
It was hard to play good football on the ground because the ground was so heavy, so it was more of a physical encounter more so than a technical game, I guess you could say.
Australia defeated New Zealand 5-3. 2 days later, the Australians faced South Vietnam.
Which was kind of an interesting match because, you know, it was a packed stadium, the hosts against Australia. Johnny Warren, the famous Australian football legend, an identity of Australian football, put Australia ahead in the first half after 35 minutes, and then all hell broke loose.
That's journalist David Corran again.
There was trouble in the stands, the riot police had to get involved, the crowd were going, were very, very upset. The players said the tear gas was even released and, you know, they were feeling pretty uncomfortable on the field there. At halftime, the South Vietnamese President Air Vice Marshal Nguyen Cao Ky went to the home side's dressing room to give them not just a kind of pick-me-up talk, but in fact offered them money to turn the result around, but it wasn't enough. Australia held on for a 1-0 win.
After the game, we were still in the dressing room and they started throw rocks at the dressing room and carry on. And from memory, I think we were kept in the dressing shed for an hour or 2 hours after the game till the police dispersed with the crowd and so forth.
So there was that real kind of sense of, this isn't just another football match. This is really kicking off in a way that these players had never experienced before. In the semi-finals, Australia met Malaysia. This was a really tight, cagey affair. There was a moment in the first half where security personnel had to come in and break up a brawl between the players because of a challenge one of the Malaysians had made on a socceroo. So this was continuing the trend of challenging difficult circumstances the Australians found themselves in.
Nil all at the end of 90 minutes, Australia finally managed to break the deadlock, 27 minutes into extra time, thanks to Ray Bartz.
I don't even remember the game, to be honest with you. Did I score, did I?
It was 1-0. You scored the winner, Ray.
I scored the winner, did I? Oh, I had a great game and scored a great goal.
Australia were through to the final on November 14, where they would face South Korea. Before the match, the players were offered an incentive if they were to win the tournament.
Well, it came from the manager, John Barclay, actually, and once we made the final, John said, look, he said, I probably haven't got the authority to do this, but I'm taking it on my own bat that if you guys win the final, you can keep your tracksuits.
And you've got to bear in mind that a lot of these players were playing for the national team unpaid. You know, you're taking annual leave to go and play for the national team. You're sacrificing to play for the national team, let alone the fact that they'd gone into a war zone and very much left their comfort zone on a mission that was in the best interests of the Australian government and Australian military.
The Australian team's PR mission had in some ways managed to work. The Vietnamese people had just seen their own team eliminated in the other semi-final. They also loathed the South Korean soldiers, so they began cheering for the Australians. And for the first time in Australian football history, the Socceroos had a chance to win an international trophy. South Korea managed to take an early lead in the final, but Australia rallied to claim a 3-2 victory and the nation's first piece of silverware. Here's Dan again.
It was fantastic. You couldn't ask for anything better.
You know, to be part of the first tournament that we ever won was fantastic. You know, we're all so thrilled and so proud to be part of it.
The magnitude of Australia's performance in the Friendship Tournament cannot be understated. Not only did they perform on the pitch, but they did it in remarkable circumstances, and all for the honour of representing their country.
To play for your country, you have to sacrifice a lot. So we sacrificed a lot, you know? A lot of kids ask me these days, oh, you're playing for Australia, you must have got a lot of money. No. You don't. You play for Australia to do one thing, to represent your country.
And in doing so, they created a legacy for Australian football. As David explains, the spirit of this team would live on through to 1974 and beyond.
The nucleus of these players formed the group that would go on to help Australia qualify for its first ever World Cup in 1974. So this tournament really helped forge their like identity as a national team, their willingness to fight and work together and be together and also be friends, because they went through so much. You still see it to this day that when the Socceroos get together, there is like a friendship and a bond amongst the playing group, that this is something that really matters. And the foundations for that were laid quite remarkably during the Vietnam War, during this tournament.
That story came to us from James Parkinson. He's the host of the Australian soccer podcast, By Association. During the opening ceremonies of the 1936 Winter Olympics, the U.S. hockey team refused to salute the Nazi leader.
Hitler berated them, told them that we will beat your American team on the ice tomorrow.
Coming up, how the backup goalie replied to Adolf Hitler. And remember, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at OnlyAGameNPR.
Before we get back to the show, we'd like to ask you about you. That's right. We want to learn more about our listeners with a short survey. It's anonymous and easy. Just go to wbur.org/survey to complete the survey right now. That's wbur.org/survey. This survey will be tremendously helpful to us. So thanks.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Next week on Only a Game, exercise, who needs it? Not people willing to ingest something marked not for human consumption. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
Probably everybody who's been watching the Winter Olympics has his or her own favorite moment. Mine was the conclusion of the women's hockey final when Jocelyn Lamoureux-Davidson deked the Canadian goalie to bring the U.S. women a gold medal.
She deeks and scores!
I assume you were watching at 2 a.m. on Thursday when that happened.
I was indeed.
Excellent.
And you and I both share a view of hockey shootouts, which is basically that they're the most exciting things in sports that should never, ever happen. It's no way to settle a gold medal.
What fun it was.
It was fun. Yeah. And very big props to 20-year-old Maddie Rooney, the American goaltender, who, by the way, as we say around the rink, stood on her head.
Stood on her head.
Absolutely.
Yeah. What say you of the actions of silver medal winner Jocelyn LaRocque?
Well, she doesn't owe me an apology. I mean, she, in the immediate aftermath of what had to be a crushing loss, took her silver medal off.
Right.
And that was considered, you know, very déclassé. Look, I understand it completely. It was a very crushing loss.
Exactly.
I don't know why she has to apologize to everyone in Canada for doing that.
I'm with you 100%. Did she spit on it? Did she throw it into the crowd? Did she crush it? No, she did none of those things.
Right.
You have expressed in the past great enthusiasm for full contact snowboarding short track speed skating. What's your favorite moment so far?
Oh, well, the short track has been okay. There's no electric moment like that time in the last Olympics where the entire field fell down and the guy in eighth place got the gold medal, the Australian dude. There's been nothing like that, but there's been a lot of replay, a lot of let's see who's really at fault here when we come around the corner. You know who's really at fault? The guy who invented short track. That's who's really at fault.
The guy who thought it would be a good idea.
But exactly. I love any sport that looks like they thought it up 15 minutes before the television went on the air. And that moment in every snowboard cross where assuming all the snowboarders are still upright, come over that last rise and they all pop up like little guys in a video game, that's fabulous.
At least two, quote, Olympic athletes from Russia have now tested positive for banned substances during these games. One was a male curler, the other a female bobsledder. Curling?
Yeah, that's the thing that surprised me. Bobsledder, I can understand because you need to be strong.
You gotta push the thing.
You gotta push the sled, exactly.
Right.
But the whole point of curling is not to throw the thing really hard, right?
Right.
I mean, the whole point of curling is to have a touch to it.
It's about finesse.
You know, I don't understand this. And I have to tell you that while curling is sort of like every American's mascot sport every Olympics, I can't get with curling.
No?
No, because first of all, nobody falls down, okay?
Well, they do occasionally.
Well, but not graphically and
not
from a great height.
This week, Louisville lost 123 basketball games and an NCAA championship, and that's before more details emerged in the FBI's probe of recruiting payments. Tough week, almost as bad as for Notre Dame last week when they lost all those football games.
Well, I think the Louisville sanction is ludicrous. If you're gonna sanction Louisville for what they're sanctioning Louisville for, then where is the sanction of Michigan State for everything Larry Nassar did?
It was also a bad week for Duke, North Carolina, Texas, Kentucky, and the aforementioned Michigan State, as well as USC and Kansas. Will there be any schools left to play basketball when the FBI is finished investigating?
First of all, this is a ridiculous, ridiculous exercise. The FBI is being used as the enforcement arm of the NCAA, which has had a bad few years because its status as a cartel is starting to fall apart right in front of it. Now they've got the FBI running the ball, naming and shaming high school players for $40 lunches. I mean, come on. This is a waste of time. And now it's starting to leak, and it's leaking like a sieve. And that always indicates to me that the FBI doesn't think it has a case. They're trying to win in a court of public opinion what they can't win in a court of law. I find this whole thing disgusting.
John Henry, the owner of the Boston Red Sox, said this week that talk of collusion was ridiculous, and I'm sure President Trump was glad to have his support.
No, not that kind of collusion. The old Peter Ueberroth era, what do we need Tim Raines for? Who, by the way, went in the Hall of Fame this year. Mm. Half of the 166 players who are currently free agents remain unsigned. Their agents and the Players Association do not think this is accidental, and neither do I.
This week, Major League Baseball announced new rules meant to speed up the game. You okay with fewer visits to the mound by the pitching coach?
Yes, that one I'll take. I'm normally kind of skeptical. I never heard anybody who said they wanted to, like, go home during a baseball game because if you're at a baseball game. But I think, these guys are professionals. They should not need their hand held as often as it is. My only problem with this is that it's not addressing my pet peeve, which is please use the pitch clock and penalize people when they break it.
The U.S., Mexico, and Canada had combined in a bid to host the 2026 World Cup, games to be played in all three countries. This week, former FIFA president Sepp Blatter said that Morocco would be a much better choice. And who can doubt Sepp Blatter?
Is he still taking bribes? I mean, is Morocco that big a sucker? They still sending him money?
No, I can see all the gray heads at FIFA nodding solemnly saying, good idea, Sepp. All right. What would our conversation be without mention of a world record?
Sports!
No, this is really...
No, it's not.
It's sort
only
of.
One guy does this.
No, two things. Anyway, the Guinness World Records people have announced that British snowboarder Jamie Barrow has traveled faster than anybody else has ever done riding a snowboard towed by a car. Guy broke his own record. I wonder if anybody but Jamie Barrow knew there was a record for going fast on a snowboard towed by a car.
You can, well, I mean, if you're the only guy in the world who does this, how do we count this as any kind of competition?
I don't know. Car was a Maserati, by the way.
Yeah, on a frozen lake, yeah. By the way.
Don't try this at home.
Absolutely not.
No. You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pearson, Sports Illustrated, from time to time. And, of course, he joins me at Only a Game every week. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
The 1936 Olympics are perhaps the most infamous example of a regime attempting to sway international opinion through a sporting event. But most of the lasting images of that spectacle, Nazi flags lining the streets of Berlin, Jesse Owens winning 4 gold medals, those images come from the 36 Summer Games. 6 months earlier, Germany hosted the Winter Olympics, and one athlete delivered an unexpected message to the Nazi leader. Here's Only a Game's Gary Wallach.
Francis F. Baker was born in Buffalo, New York in 1914.
He was a small man. He was 5'7", but he was very interested in sports and very active.
That's Baker's daughter, Jetty Hood. She and her father were fans of the Montreal Canadiens. They would frequently make the trip from their home in upstate New York to Montreal.
Now, my mother wouldn't go because she thought it was barbaric. So he would drag me along. And I really enjoyed it. I had a good time. My father had a good time being very rude to the goalie, Gump Worsley.
Gump Worsley was all-star caliber, an eventual Hall of Famer. Baker's seats at the Montreal Forum were right behind the net. He'd yell at Worsley when he thought he wasn't playing well enough. One night, the Gumper snapped.
Gump came around at the end of the game, and he shook his stick at my father. And he said, if you think you can do better than that, you get on the ice.
Baker thought maybe he could do better. So he came well prepared to the next game.
My father shows up and he has his goalie stick and his jersey. And Gump Worsley comes around, sees my father. He bows his head to my father and gave him a grin. And that was the last time he ever complained about my father screaming at him. That would be something he would do. He would stand up for things.
When Jetty was older, she'd learn about another time her father did that. Frances Baker attended Hamilton College in upstate New York during the mid-1930s. He studied the German language, among other things, and he was the goalie for the hockey team. Hamilton head coach Albert Prettyman was selected to lead the U.S. Olympic ice hockey team. In early February 1936, on the eve of the Winter Games at Garmisch-Partenkirchen, Germany, Coach Prettyman had a problem to solve, according to hockey historian Stan Fischler.
The regular goalie had taken sick before they left to take the boat across to the continent. And when that happened, Prettyman got hold of his backup goalie, Francis Baker.
Baker agreed to join the team.
And they arrived in Garmisch-Partenkirchen only 3 days before the Winter Games officially began.
Baker practiced with the team as they prepared to compete amid a political climate in which U.S.-German relations were...
Well, they weren't cordial. Certainly by that time, even though the United States under President Roosevelt was still an isolationist country, the dislike for what was going on in Germany was pretty widespread in the States.
That dislike found its way into the opening ceremonies on February 6th, 1936.
Ich erkläre die 4. Olympischen Winterspiele 1936 in Garmisch-Partenkirchen für eröffnet.
Following Hitler's declaration before a crowd of 40,000 that the 1936 Winter Games were officially open, delegations from 28 nations marched into an open-air stadium. It was a typical display of Olympic pageantry, except for the ubiquitous Nazi flags. Hitler had told the IOC of his demand to have athletes from all nations salute him in the customary Nazi fashion, with right arms extended and rigid.
And the American team did not do that. Their arms were to the sides.
They didn't acknowledge the Führer, and the Führer responded by being furious. So we had a furious Führer.
And that's what triggered Hitler to come down into the locker room.
Hitler and his cadre entered and began to shout at Coach Albert Prettyman and the team.
Hitler berated them first for the non-salute, and then he very hot-tempered told them that we will beat your American team on the ice tomorrow.
Hitler said all of this in German.
My father, who had studied German in Hamilton College, was requested to do the translating. But when the dictator confidently assured them that they could not expect to beat them in the upcoming contest, my father summed up his courage and mustered his best German to say,
"We will not only beat Germany in hockey tomorrow, in addition, die werden gegen Staaten werden Deutschland immer besiegen. The United States will always defeat Germany." And Hitler was infuriated and conducted an orderly retreat.
Later that day, the U.S. and German ice hockey teams met on Lake Riesersee.
Well, the game was an outdoor stadium in a blinding snowstorm with a throng of spectators, most of them rooting for the home team.
They described the conditions as near blizzard. Baker later explained that it snowed so hard they kept having to stop the game to clear the ice.
The game was close, but the end result, as the brazen young goalie had predicted, was a victory for the USA, 1-0.
The U.S. team went on to win bronze behind Great Britain and Canada. But Baker had made two bold predictions to Hitler. Only one of them had to do with hockey. Baker returned home, finished his undergraduate studies at Hamilton, and went on to earn his medical degree. In 1941, Baker joined the U.S. Army Medical Corps.
He landed on Normandy beachhead on D-Day plus two and followed the GIs to victory over Hitler's Germany in 45. So Baker made good on his boast, the United States will always beat Germany.
Baker returned from the war. For 25 years, he was a respected orthopedic surgeon in upstate New York. His daughter Jetty says he didn't often tell the story about his confrontation with Hitler.
He was very proud of what he did, but he was not a person to drag it out of the closet and show everybody. He was not one to talk about it very much.
Maybe that's why Baker's story has been overshadowed by the many stories told and retold about the Berlin Summer Games of August 1936. But in certain hockey circles, especially the one that encompasses Hamilton College in the quiet upstate New York town of Clinton, Baker's story still shines like a goal light through a blizzard.
As they like to say in Clinton, his most distinguishing moment was his appearance with the team and his face-off with Hitler.
That story comes to us from Only a Game's Gary Wallach. We'll have a link to more information about Francis Baker and his coach, Albert Prettyman, at onlyagame.org. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our intern is Dave Souza, and our senior producer is Karen Given. Our final word this week comes from hockey historian Stan Fischler, who recently came across a 2012 write-up of Francis Baker's confrontation with Adolf Hitler.
And the headline on it was, "He dissed Hitler with a little Teutonic trash talk."
I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.